we started our look at the fruit of the Spirit by dealing with the things that the Spirit does for us so that we will benefit from His presence in our bodies. We get a reinforcement of the concept of God's love for us. We get the joy of the life of God to experience, and we have peace with God. Those are the three issues that fundamentally affect us. And then, because we're affected that way, it's possible for the Spirit to produce the long-suffering and kindness and goodness that we express toward others that we looked at last time. And this evening we're going to be looking at the last three, called in the New American Standard, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. We'll obviously be adjusting those words because we never let any of them go by without adjusting something. But anyway, these three seem to have primarily impact on our relationship with the Father. In other words, the Spirit produces in us, He produces through us to others, and He produces toward God from us. So what we're doing is we're looking at this fruit as a single issue, but having characteristics that apply in the three different settings. It's very clear, or should be by this time in Galatians 5, that this is all a matter of the experience of the grace of God, where He takes on our situation and He gives us grace and we enter into the life. So in our study last time, we looked at the long-suffering and kindness and goodness, and we saw that there is actually a setup with that, so that long-suffering is the major characteristic, and then it has these boundaries. How long do you suffer long? Well, you have to be kind, and you have to be good toward others. And kindness has to do with not wanting to impose any kind of hurtful thing on them. But a lot of times that turns into enabling, so then goodness comes along and says, what we really have to do here is pursue the real benefit. And that sometimes is somewhat hurtful because you have to deal with hard things. So the bottom line in dealing with others is long-suffering. And then kindness, and when that doesn't work, goodness. We just made this observation. Kindness would never have cleansed the temple, and goodness couldn't keep from it. Kindness wouldn't have made a whip, and it wouldn't have overturned people's tables and spilled their coins everywhere. But goodness, because it's necessary to confront some things, couldn't not do that. It had to do that. So that's the balance. You're long-suffering with kindness and goodness on you. And that's going to be more of an issue this evening as we look at these last three. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the impact the Spirit makes upon God from us when we're walking by His Spirit in the grace and power of His Spirit. There's a recognizable order and I think a recognizable emphasis in the three characterizations that Paul identifies in the end of 22 and 23 with the faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control terms in our dealings with God. So that's what we're going to look into, the order and emphasis. The issue in verse 22 with the word faithfulness is that that's the word that's typically translated faith. And obviously faithfulness is an outworking of faith. But the question is whether he's really talking about faithfulness or not. And I think not, because the typical issue is faith. And that's one of the most fundamental issues of God dealings with us in terms of what He expects from us. He expects us to believe Him. He expects us to trust Him. From the beginning, in Genesis 3, the issue was, are you going to trust me? And the reasons for that are clear as they can be. If you're a finite creature with a limited intelligence, and without any demeaning sense of that, I mean, if you're finite, you have a finite brain, you have a finite intelligence, there's obviously going to be an almost infinite amount of information that you're not going to have access to, and yet, in a complex creation with multiple personalities, there are going to be situations developed where you're going to have somebody's input to know what to do. And the question is, whose input are you going to trust? And that was the issue. And God highlighted that when he said, don't eat of the fruit of that tree. And then Satan came in and said, it'll be okay for you to eat that. In fact, it'll be good for you to eat that. And God said, if you eat it, you'll die. Satan said, if you eat it, you won't die. So the issue of trust is automatic, and it's from there till the end of the book of the Revelation. At the end of the book of the Revelation, it presents the judgment of people in the great lake of fire thing, and it says, the fearful and unbelieving are cast into the lake. So the issue of trust, the issue of believing, the issue of faith is obviously a very crucial thing. There's only one thing more important than that, and that's love. But we'll make a comment about that in just a little bit. Point is, the focus in the scriptures upon man's relationship with God is totally wrapped up in this issue of trust. It is impossible for relationships between thinking persons, whether they're divine or angelic or human, it is impossible for relationships to survive in the absence of trust. That's absolutely crucial. It's no accident, given the reality of that, that the first thing Paul says will happen when we walk by the Spirit in relation to God is that we'll believe Him. Faith is His fruit in terms of how we're going to respond to the Father. It can't be an accident that the Spirit's most fundamental impact within us in respect to God is faith. That's what he says. The fruit of the Spirit in respect to the Father is faith. Somebody's going to come along and say, yeah, but Paul said faith, hope, and love, these three, and the grace of these is love. And that's true. Because love is an objective, it's a term that identifies what's valuable, and faith is a methodological word. It identifies methods, how you're going to accomplish what's valuable. And in that sense, love's always more important because what you chase is more important than how you chase it. But given the fact that what you chase is valuable, how you chase it is crucial because that'll decide whether you catch it or not. And even love for God, according to 1 John, even love for God is rooted in how we think about Him. John said in 1 John, we only love Him. He didn't say it that way, but that's my... We only love God after we understand, believe that He loves us first. So, even though love's a greater issue than faith is, it doesn't come into play without faith. If you don't believe that God loves you, you're never going to trust Him. On the other hand, if you really believe He loves you, you can't help but trust Him. Given some other theological characteristics. I mean, given the fact that you know God is omniscient, you know He's wise, and you know He's powerful and all, and you believe that He loves you, then you can't help but trust Him because He's smarter than you are, wiser than you are, more capable than you are, and willing. And given all of that, you can trust. You will trust. We only break down in our trust thing whenever one of those issues becomes cloudy in our thinking. We either don't think He loves us, or we don't think He's smart enough to figure this out, or we don't think He's going to exercise His power on our behalf or whatever. So even love for God has to start with faith. How we think about God cannot be divorced from the issues that are involved in trusting Him. How we think about Him. All of our thinking about God assumes that somebody's told us something about Him, or something has told us something about Him. A person on a island all by himself can learn some true theology by observation. In that case, he doesn't have somebody telling him. It's just the natural use of his mind and observance. But nonetheless, all of that comes into play with the question of, do I believe this implication from this creation, or do I believe this person who's told me God's like this? It all starts with whether you're going to believe somebody about what you're going to think about God. So, if God is any of the other gods in creation, and His character has been corrupted like all the other gods in creation, then whatever you know about that God and that character is going to determine how much you're willing to trust, and it'll be very little. That's why The first fruit of the Spirit in relation to the Father from us is faith. We have to understand that love is a faith-driven reality. Even the issue, the fruit of Spirit, is love. And we said there that the focus is on His love for us. That's a faith issue. You got to believe that, or it doesn't do you any good. So, the love thing is kind of set aside in respect to how we're going to relate to the Father. The first thing is whether we're going to believe Him or not, and the issues in faith become therefore critical. And there are certain things about faith that seem to be universally recognizable. In other words, there are certain things that are obvious to everybody when you start talking about believing somebody. So I want to highlight a couple or three or four things about the issues of faith that seem to be obvious to almost everybody that has any normal way of thinking. Fundamentally, the first thing about faith is, invariably, faith is rooted in some kind of intellectual claims. In other words, faith has some kind of content in terms of your thinking. You have to have something to believe before you can believe. I mean, that goes without saying. If somebody says, like the thoughtless supporters of some football team, they say, "You gotta believe!" Well, my question is, what do you want me to believe here? Because the other team's saying the same thing. What do you want me to believe here? What do you want them to believe? They got to believe. We got to believe. One of us is going to win. Will it be rooted in our faith? Well, that depends on what it is you're supposed to believe. And that always raises the question of content. And it's almost without debate that faith starts with an intellectual grasp of a concept or concepts. You have to have content. There has to be something to be believed. And the most dangerous issue at this point of faith is where you're going to get the content of faith. We were just in Georgetown this weekend, and our hosts over there, Dwight and Connie, and Dwight told me that a person that he had had a good bit of interaction with had just recently died. He said, did I tell you that my atheist friend died? I said, no, you didn't. He said, well, the guy mocked Dwight's faith. He said, you mean to tell me you think God's a little gray-haired man in heaven? You know. And I've got an IQ of 160-something, and I, you know, all this stuff. But he was a very bitter, angry man. And he told Dwight not too long ago, he said, I'm dying. I've got cancer and I'm going to die. And Dwight said, well, I would really like to encourage you to give some thought to your attitude about God. Well, blankety blank blank. And Dwight said, why do you say that? Why do you say God blank blank or Jesus blank blank if you don't even believe in them? Well, it's just a figure of speech. Well, I don't know whether the guy had any second thoughts before he died or not. Dwight doesn't either. But the fact is, he didn't cease to be when he died. And whatever he thought about God and the content of his faith about God is now a reality. The most dangerous issue about faith is what is the content and where did you get it? That's why Paul started the book of Galatians out with two chapters on why you ought to believe I'm telling you things that are true about God. It's crucial that the source of your content about God be God. Because He's the only one you can really trust to tell you the truth. Human beings, given all of our frailties and stuff, will sometimes tell us true things about God, and sometimes they'll tell us things that are not true about God. And they may not intend to tell us something that's not true about God, but it doesn't matter what their intention is. It matters what we hear them say. And if we believe something that's not true, then we will be misled by the deception, and whatever we trust in that deception, will cost us big time, sooner or later. So the only valid source of content about God is God Himself. That's why the concept of studying the Bible as the Word of God is so crucial. It's here that we get our content for faith. Not because it's a book, but because it's God's Word. God is the source of true content about Himself. And the issue of source is the question of whether God is at the root of the information that's being believed, as opposed to competitor gods, quasi-gods. Paul said to the Galatians, you used to be slaves to those that are not gods. You used to believe their content. You used to believe the things that they or their representatives said were true. But now that you've become known by God, that's a change has taken place. By the same token, what do you believe about God that the angels have told you? I mean, we're told in this book that the law was given by angels from Mount Sinai. And everything they told us about God was true, but it wasn't complete. So there were a lot of things built into the law that were true, but not complete. Because the angels didn't have a complete revelation themselves. They didn't have a complete understanding. They couldn't be vessels of communication of complete truth because they didn't have it. The angels desire to look into some new stuff when God starts dealing with human beings apart from the issues of justice. They say, we've never seen God like this before. What does this mean about this God we know, seeing that He's just acted like that toward that individual down there on the earth? So it doesn't matter whether they're false gods or angels that don't have a full orb, or other human beings, the preacher or the teacher or whatever, or even our own faulty mental exercises. Where we get our content about God is crucial, and the real issue is, how can I be sure that this is really from God? And again, that's why I said, Paul said, two chapters in the book of Galatians on why you ought to believe that what he's writing about God's the truth. Two whole chapters to try to answer this issue. So, the first thing that everybody recognizes is that what you believe is crucial. Where did you get that? That's even more crucial. Faith has content. The second thing that almost everybody recognizes without any question is that the issues of the claims that are made to be believed are characterized by what I call a whole person response to the claims. And the whole person response means it's going to have some physical, emotional, and spiritual ramifications. You can't divorce it. You can't just say this is a physical response without anything else, or a spiritual response, or an emotional response. It's a whole person response, involves the whole person, and in that, the response will be consistent with the claim that is being believed. By way of illustration, I fall back to the old worn out one. If I say, the house is on fire, you don't just get up and run if you believe me. That's a physical reaction driven by your confidence that what I'm telling you is the truth. But even below that, there's a turning in your stomach. There's some adrenaline that starts shooting into your blood vessels. Immediately, there's all kinds of physiological things that happen when you believe it. By the same token, if you don't believe it, you don't have those physiological reactions. At the same time, the whole idea of things being on fire, we got some kids back there. I got a wife back there. All of a sudden, there's some emotional stuff that's stirred up real big because there's more than just me involved in the threat of this fire. So I'm fearful or whatever. That's an emotional reaction. Put it in exactly the same sentence. The house is on fire. So there's a physiological, a physical thing. There's an emotional reaction based on other persons and relationships that we have. And then there's a spiritual side to it, too. Because the issue of our level of fear is going to be governed by whether or not we are trusting God in the various situation. So, the whole person is going to respond to any claim that's actually believed. And the response will always be what we used to call a commensurate response. Whatever it is that you're believing, it will create its automatic response depending on what it is. And we talked about that because it's such a complicated concept. We talk about believing God as if there was only one thing to believe, but there's not. There's a whole gamut of things that have to be believed, individual words that have to be believed to have a complete faith. Well, in no case do all of those things come into play in our minds. So the issue here is that it depends on what you're believing at the point of faith as to what you will do with it. I use this illustration. If the situation is, are you trusting the death that Christ died in your place in order to provide you with acceptance before the Father? That's the question of how do you believe you're justified before God? If your answer is yes, I trust what Christ did on my behalf. It is by faith in what he did that I get justified before God. Well, what commensurate response will that produce? What is the commensurate response for faith in that truth? Hebrews 4 says, you will cease from your labors. Those that believe the gospel cease from their labors like God ceased from his. What does that mean? It means you'll not try to work your way to heaven. You'll not try to base your confidence in your justification on your labors. You won't root it there. That's the commensurate response of faith in the gospel. In other words, you do nothing. The commensurate response is to not labor anymore. You put down this burden of trying to qualify yourself before God. You lay it aside because you believe that you don't have to do that. But if I say the house is on fire and you believe that, well, that's a whole different issue. And your response is either going to be jump and do, or it's going to be, ah, Daryl, you're just pulling our leg. You know, I ain't doing it. You can't fool me, and just sit back in your chair. See what I'm saying? It's a complicated thing. But the fact is, biblical faith is characterized by a whole person response and a commensurate response that is tied to whatever it is you're believing. Faith, biblically, does not exist apart from its effectual production of its reaction. If you say you believe something, but it doesn't sponsor the legitimate response to that truth claim, then you don't believe it. You just say you do. Everybody recognizes that. Even people who reject it recognize it, because as soon as they tell you something and you don't act like they're telling you the truth, they get offended because you, what, you think I'm lying to you? Well, why do you think that? Well, because your action. Oh, I thought you didn't believe that faith had to produce anything. Everybody recognizes it when it comes to them. That's the reason why the golden rule is the golden rule. Everybody knows what's right and what's wrong as soon as they ask this question. Would I want somebody doing that to me? As soon as they answer that question, they know. Thirdly, it seems fairly clear, though this may not be as obvious to everybody else, but the issues of faith are not only that there is a content, and it will produce a whole person reaction that's commensurate to that content, if you believe. But thirdly, there is what I'm going to just call the Monday morning questioning that happens later. When you're out of the situation and you look back on it and you begin to wonder, well, now, did I make a fool of myself by acting like that when I was told that? Does everybody think I'm an idiot now? Should I have believed that? Should I have done that based on the fact that I did believe that? This is the Monday morning quarterback thing where you look at the thing and you say, well, was it legitimate for me to believe this? Almost everybody recognizes that what you believe today, you may not believe tomorrow. Because that's true, it creates a huge theological tension, because in the scriptures, our confidence in what Christ has done for us has to be nailed down. It can't be faith for a little while. It has to be nailed down. There are too many places in the scriptures where the author either says point blankly, if you continue to believe, or if you continue in the faith, or something like that, and then you have these illustrations like in the book of Revelation, if you accept the mark of the beast, you cannot be saved. Well, what's going to keep you from receiving the mark of the beast? Only what you believe about it. If you say you believe in Jesus, but you accept the mark of the beast, then God's not going to accept your claim that you believed in Jesus, because if you receive the mark, you can't be saved. That's what the book of Revelation said. That statement implies that faith cannot be here today and not tomorrow and still be legitimate. Paul says, check yourself, see if you're in the faith. What is it that you believe today, not yesterday? Almost everybody recognizes that faith comes and goes. It can do this. And because it can happen, we need to be aware that there are certain dangers that can undo faith. Now, I don't mean by that, if you believe unto justification, that can be undone. I don't believe that. The fruit of the Spirit is faith. If he produces faith in God in the direction of justification, and God justifies you, God accepts your faith as a complete thing, it can't be undone. But all the things you believe that lead you up to that point, you're always in danger before that point, that somebody will subvert your confidence, your growing confidence. And if it's subverted before you reach this point, then you may never reach the point, because all points are the result of earlier points. So if you can be turned away at any point before you get there, you won't get there. And that's the danger in Scripture of deception. That's why Paul gives this ambivalent stance in the book of Galatians as to what he really thinks about the Galatians and whether they're truly saved or not. Because he's laboring again to try to form Christ in them, because he doesn't know what to think about them, because they are on the verge of rejecting the gospel. And then fourthly, there is also, I think, in relation to the issues of faith, something that's pretty obvious to everybody, and that is that the content of faith can be and is reinforced through multiple experiences and thoughtful considerations. And if they're reinforced sufficiently, then they cannot be easily undone. If you see God do something faithfully over and over and over in your experience, at some point you're going to be pretty confident that that's the way he's going to act in every situation like that. And if somebody comes along and says, you can't depend on God to do that, you're just going to look at him and smile. Just watch me. I've been depending on him to do it, and he's been doing it. And hey, if you don't, that's fine. That's your issue. But don't tell me that I can't depend on that, because I've been seeing him do this over and over and over. So, you know, take your unbelief somewhere else. We all recognize that the more times you see a validation of the thing you believe, the more deeply it will be driven into your basic way of looking at life. And that, of course, is what God's all about. He's trying to drive the truth deeply into us so that we are not shaken by the things that happen. And that means the Holy Spirit's got quite a job. If the fruit of the Spirit is faith toward God, he's got to deal with all four of these things. He's got to give us the content. He's got to sponsor that whole person response. He's got to overcome our Monday morning tendencies at questioning whether we should have trusted that or not. And he's got to continuously reinforce our confidence in the truth so that we can see God do what he does and then be built up in the faith. So those are the issues that seem to be, across the board, relatively accepted by people. Some of my conclusions are not, but at least the issues. So the first issue, through the Spirit in relation to our interaction with the Father, is faith. We're going to either believe him or we're not. And it will be his content, not ours, that we believe, if the Spirit of God produces faith toward the Father in us. That brings up then the next thing, and that's the meekness. It's translated gentleness in the New American Standard. And like I said, I don't know why translators choose the words they choose. Obviously, they think that they're giving the best sense, but they're choosing words in their own setting that may not be the best sense for somebody in a different setting or in a different time. The King James word is meekness. The question is, what is meekness or gentleness in terms of verse 23's first word? Well, when you look at it, it's not easy to find an answer to that question, because it's only, this particular word is only used in one place in the New Testament where the meaning is actually kind of exposed, and that's in chapter 6 of this book. Every other place that meekness is used is kind of in a grocery list thing where you can't really tell what this is from the way the words are put together. But in Galatians 6, we're told in verse 1, "Brethren, if any man is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness or gentleness, each one looking to yourself, lest you too be tempted." Well, now, when we look at that, we can say, oh, I see what meekness is. Meekness is the attitude you take toward yourself or toward God that says, when you need to confront or correct a fellow believer who has stumbled along the way, he's been caught by a trespass, you have to approach that so that you don't give that person the impression that if they were you, they wouldn't have done that. Because then you come across as holier than thou, and they're not going to listen. The whole idea is you do it in a spirit of meekness, which basically in this text boils down to an attitude about yourself in relation to God and in relation to the brother that has stumbled, an attitude that says, you know, if I'd been in your shoes when you did that, I'd have probably done it too. But that doesn't make it right. And I'm here to try to help you get over it because it's affected you badly and it's killing you, and I don't want to see you die. And I want to see if I can help you get over this, because you got to get over it. That's what restoring them means with a spirit of meekness. If I'd have been there, I'd have probably done the same way you did. But it's killing you. So this attitude of meekness is a way of thinking. And it's a way of thinking about yourself and a way of thinking about God, because we're talking here about meekness in respect to God. First three things are for us. Second three things are for those out there. Third three things for Him. What does it mean to be meek toward God? Well, that would mean then that you have to develop a way of thinking about Him in relation to yourself. And being meek means a particular thing. And I think that since the implication of Galatians 6:1 is that the way you're thinking about yourself is that you are not any stronger than your brother, you might stumble the same way he did. In other words, you don't have a lot of confidence in yourself. And that's not a bad position to be in respect to God. Because most of the time, we get in trouble with God when we think more highly of ourselves than we think of Him. Well, if God was really smart, He'd understand that my attitude toward this is better than His. I mean, that's the way it works out. We don't ever say that. That wouldn't be spiritual or pious, or it wouldn't even sound good. But that's the way we act, because we say, God isn't handling this properly. If I were God, I would do this and this and this. But God's not doing this and this and this. So what's that tell you? Well, I'm smarter than He is. That's what it tells you. So the issue in the attitude of meekness is a legitimate attitude about yourself in respect to Him, and that allows Him to have a greater focus of your confidence than yourself. Meekness, in a real sense, is no confidence in yourself, no self-confidence. It puts the other person to whom you're being meek in a position of respect, so that you allow their attitude to have a predominance in your thinking in this situation. You're being meek. You're respecting them more than you respect your own attitude or your own self. And when that's in place, meekness toward God simply means you let Him be God and you don't try to be. So, On the basis of that kind of thing, there's a guy named Trench that wrote a book on synonyms of the New Testament, and I usually go look in that book if he's handled the word that I'm looking for, because he does a good job of comparing synonyms and that kind of thing. And he said that meekness indicates a confidence in God, that the unpleasant reality of the present that calls forth meekness is under God's control for our good. In other words, meekness is saying, God knows what's going on here, He's in control of what's going on here, and He's got my good at heart. He's got my interest in mind. So it's a faith position. The first characteristic of the fruit of the Spirit toward God is faith. Well, in what direction? Well, meekness says, when you get in a situation that's unpleasant, you have to decide how you're going to deal with that in relation to your dependence on God. This unpleasant situation. How am I supposed to believe God in this unpleasant situation? Well, there are only two things you can do. You can either gripe about it because He shouldn't have done this to you, or you can submit to it knowing that He's got your best interests in mind, even though it's unpleasant. That's a very difficult concept for human beings to grasp. We tend to think that our pleasure is the ultimate objective. That's not true. Our joy is the ultimate objective, but getting to joy from here may be a very difficult process. And part of that process is dealing with unpleasant things and responding to them with faith. So meekness is a self-attitude that puts other people in position of respect, and when it comes to God, that respect translates into confidence in His control in this negative experience for my best interest. And isn't that what Romans 8:28 says, point blankly? God works everything to good for those that love Him. So, we either believe that or we don't believe it. But if we don't believe it, we're not being meek. Meekness is accepting the reality of God's control and His interest in your best interest. That's meekness. You don't tell God, you shouldn't have done this, you shouldn't have allowed this, you shouldn't have, you shouldn't have, you shouldn't have. You don't say to God, you shouldn't have. That assumes too much on your part, not enough on His. So, just like with long-suffering, having a boundary in terms of kindness and another one in terms of goodness, faith has a boundary in terms of faith in God as opposed to faith in yourself in an unpleasant setting. And that brings us to the third thing that's called self-control in the New American Standard, which I think is kind of like an oxymoron. How can the fruit of the Spirit be self-control? I would think it'd have to be spirit control. An oxymoron is like calling a fruit of the Spirit self-control, because that's not, that does not compute. The whole point of the fruit of the Spirit is that the self is not in control, and that you're not controlling the self. The Spirit of God is the one who's doing the controlling, and in that sense it might be a control of the self, but let's look at the word. The word is kind of like meekness, in the sense that it's not widely used in the New Testament. You stumble over, why does Paul talk about meekness and this thing called temperance or self-control in a way that the New Testament simply doesn't emphasize, because you can't find it very often? Why does he select these two? Well, Galatians 6:1 is a selection of the meekness thing, kind of giving us an idea that it has to do with our attitude in a negative situation in respect to somebody else. That kind of summarizes meekness. Our attitude in a negative situation about God. Is He in control? Does He have our interests in mind? That kind of thing. That's meekness. Well, in 2 Peter chapter 1, the word that's translated self-control or temperance is used in a way that I think is helpful for us to understand what it means. And it's kind of a backdoor approach. Second Peter talks about, in verses 3 and following, how we participate in God's nature when we believe His great and magnificent promises. In other words, when we trust what He said, we actually get to participate in His character, in His divine nature. He's granted to us life and godliness by these precious and magnificent promises in order that by them you might become a partaker of His character. And then he says, and for this reason, and then he starts saying, apply all diligence, in your faith supply this, in this supply that, in that supply something else, and so on. So there's this stair-step thing in verses 5 and 6 and 7. Now I want you to notice where temperance falls into play. I don't know if we can see it in our English text or not, because it depends on how they translate it, but they were consistent in verse 6 in the New American Standard. They call it self-control again. But I want you to notice what it's between. In verse 5, you're supposed to start with faith, and you're supposed to add to that moral excellence. And then, having achieved the moral excellence, you're supposed to add knowledge. So that moral excellence is between faith and knowledge. And then, to knowledge, you're supposed to add this thing called temperance or self-control or whatever it is. And then, in that, you're supposed to add perseverance, which is remaining under something. So if you take the thing that's in between, you have something that produces it and then something that it produces. And the temperance or self-control is rooted in knowledge. So knowledge produces this, and then when you've achieved this, it enables you to endure. The word is hupomeno. It means to stay under something when you would really rather not. It's kind of like you're the bar of soap, you're all wet, somebody squeezes you, what do? There you go. You didn't remain under. You responded to the pressure by squishing out. Took off. Well, that's the natural response we all have to unpleasant things. We just want to get out from under them. And by and large, it's not a bad thing. I mean, if you touch a hot stove and it's your natural reaction to jerk your hand back, good for you. It was a good thing you didn't want to endure that. I'm not going to be selfish here. I'm going to endure. That would just be plumb dumb. And there are many circumstances in our lives where we would really rather not have to face this, and it's perfectly legitimate to not face it. Do something to get out of it. But there are some things that God does not want us to do something to get out of. And you cannot help but always have the father of those who believe in mind with your illustrations here. Abraham and Sarah were in a situation where they'd been promised a son, and they were both looking for a way to get out of their childlessness. They were looking for a way to get out of that setting. They wanted to get out from under it. And it created all kinds of problems because their desire to get out from under that stressful situation caused them to make some really bad choices. And we have Islam and the conflict in the Middle East right now today because they wanted to get out from under it. They didn't want to stay under it. Which means what? That they hadn't developed this temperance thing. Whatever it is. They didn't have it because they didn't have the endurance that it produces. And if they didn't have this, what didn't they have that would have produced that? Well, according to Peter, they didn't have the right knowledge. Because knowledge produces temperance, and temperance produces the ability to hang in there. Okay? That gives us some idea of what the word means. Because Peter's statement is a link. It's between knowledge and endurance. And the link is this thing called temperance. Or New American Standard, self-control. Well, given the fact that Peter's cause and effect stair-step statements are like they are, temperance takes knowledge and develops the willingness to stay in unpleasant circumstances as long as it's the will of God for you to do so. And the strong implication then is this. Temperance is a careful reaction that does not go too far in any direction. That's probably why it's called temperance. You're temperate. You don't go too far in any direction. And you're being thoughtful about how far you go in any of those directions because you're being guided by knowledge, and you're being faced with a difficult thing that you either are going to remain under or you're not. And temperance is there to say, given this knowledge, I either have to stay under this or I can get out from under it based on the knowledge I have. And based on that, I'm going to make a careful evaluation and then I'm going to choose what I'm going to do. That means then that temperance as a characteristic is a careful reaction that says, I need to know what to do and I don't want to go too far with it. And this is in respect to God. Now stop and think about that. If the fundamental fruit of the Spirit in relation to the Father's faith, and it's bounded by, on the one side, this thing that he calls meekness. Meekness is recognizing that God's in control and he has your best interests in mind. So faith says, okay, God's in control and he has my best interests in mind. That'll enable me to handle this negative thing. The question, though, in handling this negative thing is, does God want me to stay in this negative situation, or am I free to get out from under it? That raises the issue of temperance. That means you're going to have to think about it, you're going to have to pray about it, you're going to have to be cautious about it before you make your decision, because it'll depend on what you conclude, whether you're going to stay in that situation or not. And if you are believing God, you're not primarily trying to get out from under that situation. You're trying to find out what God wants you to do. So, meekness is confidence in God that he's in control and has your best interests in mind. And temperance is confidence that God's in control and now he's guiding you to decide what your character needs in terms of whether to stay here or not. So that's how the fruit of the Spirit works in our relationship with God. Fundamentally, we're supposed to trust him. Trusting's not difficult when everything's going along fine. In fact, that might not be true. We may think we're trusting when everything's going fine, but we're really just not even thinking. Everything's just fine. Trust comes to the fore, though, when things get rocky. Difficulties arise, okay? At that situation, there are two questions. Can I trust God is in control and has my best interests in mind? And do I stay under this situation or not? Those are the two issues. And they both have to do with whether you're going to trust God or not. So that's why the fruit of the Spirit in relation to the Father is fundamentally faith, but it's bounded on both sides with the question of whether I trust that God's in control and has my best interests in mind, or am I supposed to try to get out from under this because God doesn't really want me having to be subjected to this? And those are the two issues. So what we've basically found in our study of the fruit of the Spirit in sets of three is that all three of the sets have a lead-off characteristic that have a couple of qualifiers. The fruit of the Spirit, in terms of what you get out of it, is the confidence that God loves you. The fruit of the Spirit's love. Okay, when you believe that God loves you, the first thing that happens is you get the joy and you have the peace. So those are the boundaries of confidence in his love for you. Dealing with other people, the fruit of the Spirit and dealing with other people, fundamentally, long-suffering. Well, what does that mean? Well, on the one hand, it's going to mean that you're going to have to decide whether to be kind or good. Because long-suffering with kindness means you're going to put up with it for a long time because you don't want to do any kind of response that would be hurtful in their thinking. But on the other hand, if their thinking gets twisted and you're just basically enabling them by being long-suffering, then you've got to start pursuing their good, which is goodness. And you have to start pushing the issues. And then they might get their feelings hurt and they might get offended, but that's their problem, not yours. You're being long-suffering. You're just being wise in it. And then in the third set, faith, your response to God. Well, in your response to God, there are going to be a couple of things that are going to come into play. How do you think about God when you're thinking about yourself in a negative situation? Do you elevate your wisdom above his? Do you elevate your desires above his? Do you say, I'm going to be the one respected here instead of him? That's not meekness. Meekness says, okay, I'm going to trust him in this situation. But the next question is, does he really want me to stay in this situation or not? Am I supposed to be looking for a way to endure, or am I supposed to be looking for a godly way out? That's the temperance thing. Every one of them has a primary and two secondaries, a primary and two secondaries, primary and two secondaries, and they have to do with the Spirit's production for us, the Spirit's production for everybody around us, and the Spirit's production for God through us. That's the fruit. Big concepts. But that's what Paul says happens for the people in verse 16 of chapter 5 who walk by the Spirit. They have this ninefold fruit running in three directions with three characteristics in each of the three directions. And we have covered them, and we're out of time, past time. Whoa, you guys should have said, hey, Daryl. Anyway, see, we're always looking for a way to blame somebody else. Y'all's fault. Y'all should have said, hey. Sorry about that. We're basically...